from the Oval Office at the White House, this is a special edition of Meet the Press with Tim Russert, an exclusive interview with President George W. Bush.
And we are in the Oval Office this morning with the President of the United States. Mr. President, welcome back to Meet the Press.
Thank you, sir.
On Friday, you announced a commission to look into intelligence failures regarding the Iraq War and our entire intelligence community. You have been reluctant to do that for some time. Why?
Well, first let me kind of step back and talk about intelligence in general, if I might. Intelligence is a vital part of fighting and winning the war against the terrorists. It is because the war against terrorists is a war against individuals who hide in caves in remote parts of the world, individuals who have these kind of shadowy networks, individuals who deal with rogue nations. And so we need a good intelligence system. We need really good intelligence. And so the commission I set up is to obviously analyze what went right or what went wrong with the Iraqi intelligence. There was kind of lessons learned. But it's really set up to make sure the intelligence services provide as good a product as possible for future presidents as well. This is a part of analyzing where we are on the war against terror. There is a lot of investigations going on about the intelligence service, particularly in the Congress, and that's good as well. The Congress has got the capacity to look at the intelligence gathering without giving away state secrets, and I look forward to all the investigations and looks. It's, again, I repeat to you, the capacity to have good intelligence means that a president can make good calls about fighting this war on terror.
Prime Minister Blair has set up a similar commission in Great Britain.
Yeah.
His is going to report back in July.
Right.
Ours is not going to be until March of 2005, 5 months after the presidential election.
Yeah.
Shouldn't the American people have the benefit of the commission before the election?
Well, the reason why we gave it time is because we didn't want it to be hurried. This is a strategic look, kind of a big picture look about the intelligence gathering capacities of the United States of America, whether it be the capacity to gather intelligence in North Korea, or how we used our intelligence to, for example, learn more information about AQ Khan. And it's important that this investigation take its time. We're in a political season. I fully understand people say, he's trying to avoid responsibility. There's going to be ample time for the American people to assess whether or not I made a good calls, whether or not I used good judgment, whether or not I made the right decision in removing Saddam Hussein from power. And I look forward to that debate, and I look forward to talking to the American people about why I made the decisions I made. The commission I set up, Tim, is one that will help future presidents understand how best to fight the war on terror. And it's an important part of the kind of lessons learned in Iraq and lessons learned in Afghanistan prior to us going in, lessons learned that we can apply to both Iran and North Korea, because we still have a dangerous world. And that's very important for, I think, the people understand where I'm coming from, to know that this is a dangerous world. I wish it wasn't. I'm a war president. I make decisions here in the Oval Office in foreign policy matters with war on my mind. And again, I wish it wasn't true, but it is true. And the American people need to know they've got a president who sees the world the way it is. And I see dangers that exist, and it's important for us to deal with them.
Will you testify before the commission?
This commission? You know, I don't testify. I mean, I'd be glad to visit with them. I'd be glad to share with them knowledge. I'd be glad to make recommendations if they ask for some. I'm interested in getting, I'm interested in making sure the intelligence gathering works well. Listen, we've got some fine, let me again just give you a sense of where I am on the intelligence systems of America. First of all, I strongly believe the CIA is ably led by George Tenet. He comes and briefs me on a regular basis about what he and his analysts see in the world.
His job is not in jeopardy.
No, not at all. Not at all. We've got people working hard in intelligence gathering around the world to get as good an information as possible. Intelligence requires all kinds of assets to bring information to the president. And I want that intelligence service to be strong, viable, competent, confident, and provide good product to the president so I can make judgment calls.
There's another commission right now looking into September 11th.
Yeah.
Will you testify before that commission?
We have given extraordinary cooperation with Chairman Keene and Hamilton. As you know, we made an agreement on what's called presidential daily briefs, so they could see the information the CIA provided me. That is unique, by the way, to have provided the what's called the PDB, because
presidential daily brief.
Right, and see the danger of allowing for information that I get briefed on out in the public arena is that it could mean that the product that I receive or future presidents receive is somewhat guarded for fear of it being revealed, for fear of people saying, well, you know, we're going to second guess that which you told the president. I need good, honest information. But we have shared this information with both those gentlemen I trust, so they can get a better picture of what took place prior to September the 11th. And again, I want the truth to be known. I want there to be a full analysis done, so that we can better prepare the homeland, for example, against what might occur. This is all in the context of war. And the more we learn about, you know, what took place in the past, the more we're going to be able to better prepare for future attacks.
Would you submit for questioning, though, to the 911 Commission?
Perhaps.
Senator Charles Grassley, a Republican,
yes?
said he is absolutely convinced we will capture Osama bin Laden before the election.
Well, I appreciate his optimism. I have no idea whether we'll capture or bring him to justice, maybe the best way to put it. I know we're on the hunt. And Osama bin Laden is a cold-blooded killer. And he represents the nature of the enemy that we face. These are people that'll kill on a moment's notice. And they'll kill innocent women and children. And he's hiding. And we're trying to find him. I know there's a lot of focus on Iraq, and there should be. But we've got thousands of troops, agents, allies on the hunt. And we're doing a pretty good job of dismantling al-Qaeda, better than a pretty good job, a very good job. I keep saying in my speeches, 2/3 of known al-Qaeda leaders have been captured or killed, and that's the truth. And
we have a pretty good idea where Osama is?
I'm not going to comment on that.
Let me turn to Iraq. And this is the whole idea of what you based your decision to go
sure,
to war on.
Sure.
The night you took the country to war, March 17th, you said this. Intelligence gathered by this and other governments leaves no doubt that the Iraq regime continues to possess and conceal some of the most lethal weapons ever devised.
Right.
That apparently is not the case.
Correct.
How do you respond to critics who say that you brought the nation to war under false pretenses?
Yes. First of all, I expected to find the weapons. I'm sitting behind this desk making a very difficult decision of war and peace, and I based my decision on the best intelligence possible, intelligence that had been gathered over the years, intelligence that not only our analysts thought was valid, but analysts from other countries thought was valid. And I made a decision based upon that intelligence in the context of the war against terror. In other words, we were attacked, and therefore every threat had to be reanalyzed. Every threat had to be looked at. Every potential harm had to be judged in the context of this war on terror. And I made the decision, obviously, to take our case to the international community in the hopes that we could do this. Achieve a disarmament of Saddam Hussein peacefully. In other words, we looked at the intelligence and we remembered the fact that he had used weapons, which meant he had weapons. We knew the fact that he was paying for suicide bombers. We knew the fact that he was funding terrorist groups. In other words, he was a dangerous man. And that was the intelligence I was using prior to the run-up to this war. This is a vital question.
Nothing more important.
Vital question. And so we expected, or I expected, there to be stockpiles of weapons. But David Kay has found the capacity to produce weapons. In other words, David Kay goes in and says, we haven't found stockpiles yet, and there's theories as to where the weapons went. They could have been destroyed during the war. Saddam and his henchmen could have destroyed them as we enter into Iraq. They could be hidden. They could have been transported to another country. And we'll find out. That's what the Iraqi survey group, let me finish here. But David Kay did report to the American people that Saddam had the capacity to make weapons. Saddam Hussein was dangerous with weapons. Saddam Hussein was dangerous with the ability to make weapons. He was a dangerous man in the dangerous part of the world. And I made the decision to go to the United Nations. By the way, quoting a lot of their data, in other words, this is the unaccounted for stockpiles that you thought he had, because I don't think America can stand by and hope for the best from a madman. And I believe it is essential that when we see a threat, we deal with those threats before they become imminent. It's too late if they become imminent. It's too late in this new kind of war. And so that's why I made the decision I made.
Mr. President, the director of the CIA said that his briefings had qualifiers and caveats. But when you spoke to the country, you said there is no doubt. When Vice President Cheney spoke to the country, he said it's no doubt. Secretary Paul, no doubt. Secretary Rumsfeld, no doubt. We know where the weapons are. You said, quote, the Iraqi regime is a threat of unique urgency. Saddam Hussein is a threat that you must deal with as quickly as possible. You gave the clear sense that this was an immediate threat that must be dealt with.
I think, if I might, remind you that in my language, I call it a grave and gathering threat. But I don't want to get in the word contest, but what I do want to share with you my sentiment at the time. There was no doubt in my mind that Saddam Hussein was a danger to America.
In what way?
No doubt. Well, because he had the capacity to have a weapon, make a weapon. We thought he had weapons. The international community thought he had weapons. But he had the capacity to make a weapon and then let that weapon fall into the hands of a shadowy terrorist network. It's important for people to understand the context in which I made a decision here in the Oval Office. I'm dealing with a world in which we have gotten struck by terrorists with airplanes, and we get intelligence saying that we want to harm America. And the worst nightmare scenario for any president is to realize that these kind of terrorist networks have the capacity to arm up with some of these deadly weapons and then strike us. And the president of the United States' most solemn responsibility is to keep this country secure. And the man was a threat. And we dealt with him. And we dealt with him because we cannot hope for the best. We can't say, let's don't deal with Saddam Hussein. Let's hope he changes his stripes. Or let's trust in the goodwill of Saddam Hussein. You know, let us kind of try to contain him. Containment doesn't work with a man who is a madman. And remember, Tim, he had used weapons against his own people.
But can you launch a preemptive war without ironclad, absolute intelligence that he had weapons of mass destruction?
Let's take a step back for a second. And there is no such thing necessarily in a dictatorial regime of ironclad, absolutely solid evidence. The evidence I had was the best possible evidence that he had a weapon.
But it may have been wrong.
Well, but what wasn't wrong was the fact that he had the ability to make a weapon. But that wasn't wrong.
This is an important point, because when you say that he has biological and chemical weapons and unmanned aerial vehicles,
which he had,
and they could come and attack the United States, you're saying to the American people, we have to deal now with a man who has these things.
Exactly what I said.
And if that's not the case, do you believe if you had gone to the Congress and said, he should be removed because he's a threat to his people, but I'm not sure he has weapons of mass destruction, Congress would authorize war?
I went to Congress with the same intelligence. Congress saw the same intelligence I had. And they looked at exactly what I looked at. And they made an informed judgment based upon the information that I had. The same information, by the way, that my predecessor had. And all of us, you know, made this judgment that Saddam Hussein needed to be removed. But you mentioned preemption. If I might, I went to the United Nations and said, here's what we know, you know, at this moment. And you need to act. After all, you were the body that issued resolution after resolution after resolution, and he ignored those resolutions. So in other words, when you say preemption, it almost sounds like, well, Mr. President, you decided to move. What I decided to do is go to the international community and see if we could not disarm Saddam Hussein peacefully through international pressure. You remember UN Security Council Resolution 1441 clearly stated, show us your arms and destroy them, or your programs and destroy them.
You know, there's
And there was, and it said, there's serious consequences if you don't. And that was a unanimous verdict. In other words, the world through the UN Security Council said, we're unanimous in your danger. So it wasn't just me in the United States. The world thought he was dangerous and needed to be disarmed. And of course, he defied the world once again. And in my judgment, when the United States says there will be serious consequences, and if there isn't serious consequences, it creates adverse consequences. People look at us and say, they don't mean what they say. They're not willing to follow through. And by the way, by clearly stating policy, whether it be in Afghanistan, or stating the policy that we expect you, Mr. Saddam Hussein, to disarm, your choice to disarm, but if you don't, there'll be serious consequences in following through. It has had positive effects in the world. Libya, for example. There was a positive effect in Libya where Muammar Gaddafi voluntarily disclosed his weapons programs and agreed to dismantle them, and the world is a better place as a result of that. And the world is a safer and better place as a result of Saddam Hussein not being in power.
There's a sense in the country that the intelligence that was given was ambiguous, and that you took it and molded it and shaped it, your opponents have said hyped it, and rushed to war.
Yeah.
And now in the world, if you in the future say, we must go into North Korea, or we must go into Iran because they have nuclear capability, neither this country or the world will say, excuse me, Mr. President, we want it now in hard, cold facts.
Well, Tim, I and my team took the intelligence that was available to us, and we analyzed it, and it clearly said Saddam Hussein was a threat to America. Now, again, I know I'm getting repetitive, but I'm just trying to make sure you understand the context in which I was making decisions. He had used weapons. He had manufactured weapons. He had funded suicide bombers into Israel. He had terrorist connections. In other words, all of those ingredients said to me, threat. The fundamental question is, do you deal with the threat once you see it? In the war on terror, how do you deal with threats? I dealt with the threat by taking the case to the world and said, let's deal with this. We must deal with it now. I repeat to you what I strongly believe, that inaction in Iraq would have emboldened Saddam Hussein. He could have developed, and over time, I'm not saying immediately, but over time, which would have then put us in what position? We would have been in a position of blackmail. In other words, you can't rely upon a madman, and he was a madman. You can't rely upon him making rational decisions when it comes to war and peace. And it's too late, in my judgment, when a madman who's got terrorist connections is able to act.
But there are lots of madmen in the world. Fidel Castro in Iran, in North Korea, in Burma. And yet we don't go in and take down those governments.
Correct. And that's a legitimate question as to why we felt like we needed to use force in Iraq and not in North Korea. And the reason why I felt like we needed to use force in Iraq and not in North Korea, because we had run the diplomatic string in Iraq. As a matter of fact, failed diplomacy could embolden Saddam Hussein in the face of this war we're in. In North Korea, the diplomacy is just beginning. We're making good progress in North Korea. As I said in my speeches, every situation requires a different response and a different analysis. And so in Iran, there's no question they're a danger. But the international community is now trying to convince Iran to get rid of its nuclear weapons program. And on the Korean Peninsula, now the United States and China, along with South Korea and Japan and Russia, are sending a clear message to Kim Jong-il. If you're interested in a different relationship, disclose and destroy your program in a transparent way. In other words, the policy of this administration is to be clear and straightforward, and to be realistic about the different threats that we face.
On Iraq, the Vice President said we would be greeted as liberators.
Yeah.
It's now nearly a year, and we are in a very difficult situation. Did we miscalculate how we would be treated and received in Iraq?
Well, I think we are welcomed in Iraq. I'm not exactly sure, kind of the tone of your question is we're not. We are welcomed in Iraq.
Are you surprised by the level and intensity of resistance?
No, I'm not. And the reason I'm not surprised is because there are people in that part of the world who recognize what a free Iraq will mean in the war on terror. In other words, there are people who desperately want to stop the advance of freedom and democracy because freedom and democracy will be a powerful long-term deterrent to terrorist activity. See, free societies are societies that don't develop weapons of mass terror and don't blackmail the world. If I could share some stories with you about some of the people I've seen from Iraq, the leaders from Iraq, there's no question in my mind, the people that I have seen at least are thrilled with the activities we've taken. There is a nervousness about their future, however.
If the Iraqi people choose...
Well, let me finish on the nervousness. I don't want to leave it on that note. There's nervousness because they're not exactly sure what their form of government will look like, and you can understand why. In 9 months' time, we're now saying democracy must flourish. And as I recall from my history, it took us quite a while here in the United States, but nevertheless, we're making progress. And so when you see the debate and the discussion about freedom, those are welcoming signs as far as I'm concerned. I mean, people are saying how best to develop this system so that we're free and minority rights are protected.
If the Iraqis choose, however, an Islamic extremist regime, would you accept that? And would that be better for the United States than Saddam Hussein?
They're not going to develop that. And the reason I can say that is because I'm very aware of this basic law they're writing. They're not going to develop that because right here in the Oval Office, I sat down with Mr. Pachachi and Shalabi and Al-Hakim, people from different parts of the country that have made the firm commitment that they want a constitutional eventually written that recognizes minority rights and freedom of religion. I remember speaking to Mr. Al-Hakim here, who's a fellow who's lost 63 family members during the Saddam reign. His brother was one of the people was assassinated early on in this past year. I expected to see a very bitter person. If 63 members of your family had been killed by a group of people, you'd be a little bitter. He obviously was concerned, but I said, I'm a Methodist. What are my chances of success in your country and your vision? And he said, it's going to be a free society where you can worship freely. This is a Shia fella. And my only point to you is these people are committed to a pluralistic society. And it's not going to be easy. The road to democracy is bumpy. It's bumpy particularly because these are folks that have been terrorized, tortured, brutalized by Saddam Hussein.
You do seem to have changed your mind from the 2000 campaign. In the debate, you said, I don't think our troops ought to be used for what's called nation building.
Yeah.
We clearly are involved in nation building.
Right. And I also said, well, let me put it in context. I'm not suggesting you're pulling one of these Washington tricks where you leave half the equation out. But I did say also that our troops must be trained and prepared to fight and win war, and therefore make peace more possible. And our troops were trained to fight and win war, and we did. And a second phase of the war is now going on. The first phase, of course, was the Tommy Franks troop movement.
But this is nation building.
Well, it is, that's right. But we're also fighting a war so that they can build a nation.
And, will the United Nations...
And the war is against terrorists, and disgruntled Baathists who are saying, well, we had it good in the past, And therefore, we don't want this new society to spring up because they have no faith in democracy. Right. And the terrorists who want to stop the advance of freedom. And if I might, but people say to me, okay, you made a judgment as to how to secure America for the short term with the Taliban and with Saddam Hussein and with staying on the hunt for Al-Qaeda. But what about the long term? Which is a legitimate question. And the best way to secure America for the long term is to promote freedom and a free society and to encourage democracy. And we're doing so in a part of the world where people say it can't happen. But the long-term vision and the long-term hope is, and I believe it's going to happen, is that a free Iraq will help change the Middle East. You may have heard me say, we have a forward strategy of freedom in the Middle East. It's because I believe so strongly that freedom is etched in everybody's heart. I believe that. And I believe this country must continue to lead.
Are you now willing to allow the United Nations to play a central role in the reconstruction?
Spending our money? No, they don't want to spend our money. The money that was appropriated by the United States Congress, I think you're talking about, but they will play a vital role in helping the Iraqis determine the proper course to democracy.
In transferring power, the UN will play a central role.
Yeah, I call it a vital role because there's a lot of roles being played by different players. But the UN will play, and this role is a very important role. It says to the Iraqi citizens who, again, are trying to figure out the right balance as they head toward this new democracy after years of being enslaved by a tyrant, how best to do this. And I think it's very helpful to have the stamp of the international community be placed upon the political process. In terms of reconstruction, of course we want the international community to participate, and they are. There's a lot of participation by the international community in restoring this infrastructure of the country of Iraq that Saddam Hussein had just destroyed a lot of.
Before we take a break, now that we have determined there are probably not these stockpiles of weapons that we had thought, and the primary rationale for the war had been to disarm Saddam Hussein, Paul Wolfowitz, Deputy Defense Secretary, said that you had settled on weapons of mass destruction as an issue we could agree on. But there were three. One's the weapons of mass destruction, the second is support for terrorism, and third is Saddam's criminal treatment of his Iraqi people. He said the third one by itself is a reason to help the Iraqis, but it's not a reason to put American kids' lives at risk, certainly not on the scale we did. Mm-hmm. Now looking back, in your mind, is it worth the loss of 530 American lives and 3,000 injuries and woundings simply to remove Saddam Hussein, even though there were no weapons of mass destruction? Mm.
Every life is precious. Every person that is willing to sacrifice for this country deserves our praise. And yes.
Do you think?
Let me finish.
Please.
It's essential that I explain this properly to the parents of those who've lost their lives. Saddam Hussein was dangerous, and I'm not going to leave him in power and trust a madman. He's a dangerous man. He had the ability to make weapons, the very minimum. For the parents of the soldiers who've fallen, who are listening, David Kay, the weapon inspector, came back and said, in many ways, Iraq was more dangerous than we thought. We're in a war against these terrorists who will bring great harm to America. And I've asked these young ones to sacrifice for that. A free Iraq will change the world. It's historic times. A free Iraq will make it easier for other children in our own country to grow up in a safer world, because in the Middle East is where you find the hatred and violence that enables the enemy to recruit its killers. And Tim, as you can tell, I've got a foreign policy that is one that believes America has a responsibility in this world to lead. A responsibility to lead in the war against terror, a responsibility to speak clearly about the threats that we all face, a responsibility to promote freedom, to free people from the clutches of barbaric people such as Saddam Hussein, who tortured, mutilated. There were mass graves that we have found. A responsibility to fight AIDS, the pandemic of AIDS, and to feed the hungry. We have a responsibility. To me, that is history's call to America. I accept the call and will continue to lead in that direction.
In light of not finding the weapons of mass destruction, do you believe the war in Iraq is a war of choice or a war of necessity?
I think that's an interesting question. Please elaborate on that a little bit. A war of choice or a war of necessity? I mean, it's a war of necessity. My judgment, we had no choice when we look at the intelligence I looked at that says the man was a threat. And we'll find out about the weapons of mass destruction that we all thought were there. That's part of the Iraqi survey group and the group I've put together to look at. But again, I repeat to you, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but David Kaye, who was the man who led the Iraqi survey group, who has now returned with an interim report, clearly said that the place was a dangerous place. When asked if President Bush had made the right decision, he said yes. In other words, the evidence we have uncovered thus far says we had no choice.
We're going to take a quick break.
Thank you.
We're going to go back and talk to the president a lot more about our world and our economy here at home and the presidential election of 2004. We're in the Oval Office with President George W. Bush.